Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning. This hour of the program, the story of the 26-year civil war that has fractured Sri Lanka. News reports over the past couple days say that it has come to a horrific close with a surviving Tamil Tiger rebel leader declaring an end to their struggle to build a breakaway military state. Island has an interesting history. Before the British took over, it was a sacred paradise where Buddhists, Hindus, and Muslims lived peacefully side by side. The island was ceded to the British in 1796, became a crown colony in 1802, and was united under British rule by 1815. There was a long-established Tamil minority in the north and the east. The British brought in laborers, Tamil laborers, to work the coffee and tea plantations, but the majority Buddhist Sinhalese community resented what they saw as favoritism toward the mainly Hindu Tamils under the British administration. Tensions between the majority and the separatists erupted into war in 1983. Tens of thousands have died in the ethnic conflict, most of the fighting taking place in the north. But the conflict also penetrated the heart of Sri Lankan society, with Tamil Tiger rebels carrying out devastating suicide bombings in the 1990s. This hour of the program, we'll talk about, and there's been a lot of international involvement in trying to negotiate some peace here, particularly on the part of the Canadians, which I find interesting, the Norwegians as well, and the United States had declared the Tamil Tigers a terrorist organization. Joining us this hour is a woman who grew up, actually was born in Sri Lanka and did her education in other parts of the world. Professor Asoke Badaragay is an affiliated associate professor of public policy at the Georgetown Institute, teaches conflict analysis and resolution, women in international society. She's the author of The Separatist Conflict in Sri Lanka, Terrorism, Ethnicity, Political Economy, and Colonialism in Sri Lanka, and many other publications on South Asia. She has taught at Yale, Brandeis, McAllister, and Mount Holyoke. And the book is a historically based analysis of the origin, evolution, and potential resolution of the civil conflict in Sri Lanka. Professor Asoke Badaragay, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak. Yes.
So what happened in the last couple of days? Is the conflict over?
Yes, the military conflict is definitely over. It is a comprehensive victory for the Sri Lankan government in the sense that all the civilians have been liberated from the clutches of the LTTE, and the LTTE leadership, including Prabhakaran, you know, have been done away with. So in that sense, it is a definite military victory.
It has been going on for such a long period of time, such intense fighting for two decades. Can you tell me what sparked it? What started all this intense violence 20 years ago?
Yeah, it is a very complicated situation, and I'll try to be brief.
Oh, we have time. It's okay.
Yes. During the British colonial period, the Tamil minority, and by that one doesn't mean the entire Tamil population, but a particular caste known as the Jaffna Vellala Tamils, gained a privileged position both economically and politically because of greater access to English language education and therefore university education and employment at the higher levels of the civil service administration and the modern professions. The British actually treated this Tamil minority, which was at that point about, say, 11% of the population, as a majority community. Mm. So although they were numerically much smaller than the Sinhala majority, which was roughly around 70% at that time, they had equal power politically, and the British were actually grooming the Vellala Tamil elite to be in some ways their successors. But with the introduction of democratic politics, that is the universal franchise, and Sri Lanka was one of the one, if not the first country in Asia to have universal franchise, the Sinhala majority was empowered politically. And after independence, there was an attempt to redress inequalities that were put in place during the British colonial period. And actually, the policies of the post-independence period in terms of language and education were not directed just against the privileged Tamil elite, but against elites of all ethnic groups, including the Sinhalese. But the Tamil elite, you know, who found it very difficult to accept their new minority status, interpreted this as ethnic discrimination. Over time, because of, you know, violence and marginalization of their interests, supported a separatist movement to create a separate Tamil state in the northern and eastern provinces. But here I also need to emphasize that the movement for a separate Tamil state of Elam actually preceded these state policies of the 50s and 60s. The federal party was established at the time of independence, you know, immediately after independence from the British in 1949. And in English, it was referred to as the federal party, but actually in Tamil, it read as the Tamil State Party. So there was a separatist ambitions even prior to independence and the post-independence policies of the government. So these developments led to the Tamil elite mobilizing the Tamil youth towards the creation of a separate state, and the Tamil youth became, you know, much more militant and took up arms. But again, it is interesting to note that the first armed rebellion in post-independence Sri Lanka was led by Sinhala youth, not the Tamil youth, because they had exactly the same grievances that the Tamil youth had in terms of, you know, lack of white-collar employment, cultural and political marginalization, and the sense of alienation from the political center and the elites in Colombo, the capital of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So in this very narrow interpretation of the conflict as a bipolar ethnic conflict, these common grievances across the ethnic divides often get lost.
Mm.
And I think it's really important to recognize these common grievances of the youth from all different backgrounds, particularly in the rural areas, in terms of trying to build reconciliation and unity in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And one other aspect, you know, you asked me to talk about the sort of the root causes.
Sure.
That I want to throw in here is the role of South India. In South India, and, you know, Sri Lanka is very close in physical proximity to South India. It's at the southern tip of India. There was a very vociferous movement to create a separate Dravidian state in southern India, a Dravidistan that is dominated by Tamil Nadu, where today there are some 65 to 70 million Tamil speakers live, because there was a feeling on the part of Tamil leaders even prior to independence from the British, that is India's independence from the British, that following independence, the Hindi-speaking northern India would dominate over South India. But after, in 1963, and there had been, you know, mass protests and even violence in this effort against Hindi dominance and the northern dominance in India. In 1963, a draconian amendment to the Indian constitution was introduced, outlawing secession. And this sort of led to the Tamil separatist interests moving to Sri Lanka.
I see.
In conjunction with local developments, it emerged into a full-blown secessionist movement. But in many ways, the Sri Lankan conflict or the war could be seen as a kind of a proxy war, a surrogate war, you know, from India to Sri Lanka.
And tell me initially why it was that the Tamils were the favored people. Why did the British choose this group?
Well, I think, I don't want to simply attribute this to divide and conquer policies, but the British and colonial powers historically have had a pattern of using minorities in order to rule these distant lands. And the majority communities have oftentimes been the most resistant against colonialism, and that has been the case in the Sri Lankan in Sri Lanka. So that the Tamils were in some ways incorporated into the colonial administrative structure, but that was also because there were more Christian missionary schools that were available to the Tamil community in the northern region. So they had an advantage in terms of access to English and modern education and therefore employment, so on and so forth. So, it was both conscious and unconscious factors, that led to the creation of a privileged Tamil elite, which is not to say that there wasn't a privileged Sinhala elite, but proportionally speaking, there were more Tamils in, say, the medicine, faculty of medicine, accountancy, the more sought-after faculties in the university and in the professions.
Right.
And I provide, the data in my book.
Tell me what the situation is right now, Professor. We're hearing news reports that there are hundreds of thousands of refugees. There are people who are starving. Are there sufficient humanitarian efforts going on to take care of the people who have been ravaged by this long war? Where will they go?
Yes, I think that is a priority issue right now. The welfare of the IDPs and their resettlement and rehabilitation. And I think even before the military confrontation was ended, there were some 50-odd or more INGOs, that is humanitarian organizations, working in the various centers where the IDPs were settled. And so I think that the focus now is on their welfare, rehabilitation, and resettlement in their villages of origin. So I think that that should not be lost sight of during this time of victory on the part of some groups and revenge or alleged revenge on the part of some other groups.
Mm-hmm. One of the press reports yesterday was saying that the government has so restricted the freedoms of the refugees, locking them behind barbed wire, strictly controlling movement, that there are grave fears of a self-perpetuating spiral of violence and ethnic polarization that could prove worse than the civil war itself.
Yes, I think that's why it's very important to take the right decisions right now rather than, seeing this as a sort of a once-for-all victory. I think peace should be approached as a process which requires a lot of work on the part of all groups. And this humanitarian issue was cited for weeks as a reason for a ceasefire, particularly on the part of the international community. But actually, if a ceasefire had been called, it would have delayed the ending of the military conflict, because there were two pauses in the fighting that the government accepted. And during those two humanitarian pauses in the fighting, the LTT actually used those opportunities to build itself up by recruiting more, child cadres and building earthen embankments to prevent civilians from running away from their hold, etc. But now that the military confrontation is over and the LTT is put behind us, this is really a time to reach out to the Tamil civilians and to provide them, all the support that they need, both physically and emotionally, and to really rebuild the society. And for that, the international support of India, the diaspora are all extremely important.
I read something that just caught my interest, that the government of Canada has been helping in negotiations here, seems to have a deep interest in what's going on in Sri Lanka. Why is that the case?
Because Canada has the largest Sri Lankan diaspora population.
Oh.
Some 400,000 Sri Lankan Tamils are now residing in Canada. And Toronto, interestingly, is the largest has the largest Sri Lankan Tamil population outside of Asia, or maybe even the largest one in the whole world. And they have been, you know, very active. They are very influential and mostly wealthy diaspora. So they've been able to put pressure on Canadian politicians. And that's one of the reasons. And, of course, you know, there is a deep concern about what is happening to Tamil civilians, but also on the part of LTT supporters, an attempt to, you know, influence politics. So Canada, for those reasons, has historically, over the last many decades, played an important role.
So would it be safe to say that in order for there to be peace in Sri Lanka, you would have to have some kind of power sharing with the minority, the Tamil minority, which has never happened before?
Well, you know, the one thing to remember is that Sri Lanka has a parliamentary democracy. It is the first country to receive universal franchise, and it has had a long-running parliamentary democracy, which allows different groups, including ethnic groups, to participate in the parliamentary process in order to get their rights and aspirations met. And many minority groups have actually used those opportunities to address their concerns. You know, if you look at the Muslim minority, which is a very significant one, then there are also different Tamil groups, not just the Sri Lankan Tamil community, which has, you know, been interested in creating a separate state in the north and east, but there's also the group that you mentioned earlier, the Indian Tamil population, descendant from laborers who were brought from South India.
Mm.
For them, from the their main interest was integration into the political system in Sri Lanka, and their struggle was for decades to gain citizenship rights, because, you know, they were part of the immigrant labor force. So they have now gained citizenship rights and complete rights within the political system, and have been able to advance their interests through the political process. In hindsight, one can say that the Sri Lankan Tamil minority should have used the parliamentary democratic system more effectively, but because they were interested in creating a separate state, they moved away from that. Which is not to say that, you know, the Sri Lankan state and Sinhala politicians didn't make mistakes or have no responsibility for the emergence of the struggle, but I'm just saying that it is important to recognize that Sri Lanka is a functioning parliamentary democracy. Now, going back to your question about a political devolution for the North and the East, leaving aside the issue that there is no historical basis for a separate Tamil state in the North and the East, and I myself have written on this subject, not in this particular book, but in elsewhere, and others have documented this, that the North and the East were historically, that is in pre-colonial times, pluralistic, multicultural regions, you know, which where Buddhists, Hindus, and later Muslims and Christians all lived together. But leaving the historical, lack of a historical basis to create a Tamil Elam in the North and the East, I think it's really important to look at current demographic realities. Because in the eastern province, the Tamils are not a majority. The Sinhalese and the Muslims together constitute a majority. In the north, the Sinhalese and the Tamils, the Muslims, were ethnically cleansed by the LTTE in creating a mono-ethnic state. But the important thing is that the majority of Sri Lankan Tamils in Sri Lanka today do not live in the north and the east. The majority live in the so-called south, outside of the northern and eastern provinces. So to create an autonomous, sort of an exclusive Tamil region in the north and the east is not justifiable because the majority of them are living outside the north and the east. I think the important thing is to recognize that this is a pluralistic nation and recognize and uphold the right of any ethnic or religious group, individuals from any ethnic or religious group, to live anywhere on the island, to hold property and reside and work anywhere on the island. And it is within those parameters that any kind of political decentralization needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Maybe everybody needs to remember the very nice history when everybody lived together and got along.
Well, I mean, it was not all that romantic, and, you know, certainly there were wars and so on and so forth. But still, the predominant pattern of history has been one of mutual coexistence and harmony. And if you go to Sri Lanka today, and if you look outside of the northern areas where the LTTE held sway until recently, you see that people live, you know, harmoniously. They get along with each other, and it is just some extremist elements, you know, that created this unfortunate situation.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Professor Soka Badarage is affiliated associate professor, Public Policy Institute at Georgetown University, was born in Sri Lanka and attended school there until she did higher education. This is all over the news because of the humanitarian crisis and because we hope the end of a fairly long war. And also we have yet to talk about the terrorist groups in this nation. The United States has identified the Tamil Tigers, the Bush administration did, as a terrorist group. And some press reports have said this was the first suicide bombing group in this part of Asia. We'll talk about that group and their tactics, and whether or not these are truthful reports. So all of that is coming up. And I know that many of us have basic questions. It's hard to keep up on everything that's going on all over the world, but this is a significant development in this part of Asia. And then we've got the involvement of the Canadian government and the number of people who have gone to Canada. As our guest said, I wasn't aware of that. And Indian involvement in the refugee problem, etc. Here's our number, and some of you listening may be keenly interested in this and know a great deal because you're a good audience. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you are so welcome to do that. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we'll be talking with the author of a wonderful book on Shakespeare, Jonathan Bate, a professor of Shakespeare and Renaissance Literature at the University of Warwick, will be with us. He has written his latest book, lots of books about Shakespeare, Soul of the Age, The Life, Mind, and World of William Shakespeare. Sri Lanka This Hour, feel free to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number for you to join us, or you can send an email, and that email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. The press, of course, focuses on terrorism, Professor, and I'm wondering, we have this description of the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, considered the prototype of modern terrorism and known to have introduced suicide bombing to the world. Is this true? Can you tell me about this group?
Yes. It's considered the prototype of modern terrorism in the sense that it introduced the suicide bomb belt. It was also the first terrorist organization to acquire air power and carry on suicide bombings on a massive scale, including the first organization and the only organization to have assassinated a leader of a government, and these included Rajiv Gandhi, the Prime Minister of India, and Ranasinghe Premadasa, President of Sri Lanka. It's also a very, sophisticated terrorist organization in terms of its insurgency network that it created around the world. And according to Jane's intelligence and other sources, you know, created something of a multinational empire in terms of both its licit and illicit activities, including manning a fleet of ships, narcotics trade, credit card fraud, and also legal activities like running restaurants and gas stations around the world.
Mm-hmm. And what would be the significant or the reasons for assassination of the Indian Prime Minister?
Because in 1987, India directly intervened in Sri Lanka, both militarily and politically, and it actually led to one of the worst periods of violence in Sri Lanka and a direct military confrontation between the Indian peacekeeping forces that were sent from India and the LTTE. And the IPKF left in defeat. And before the subsequent elections, LTTE killed the Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi, fearing that he would return to power and carry on a campaign against it. But that assassination is considered one of the worst mistakes that the LTTE ever made, because it turned Indian as well as international opinion against it, although it had tried to present itself as the liberator and the representative of the Tamil community in Sri Lanka.
Mm. And their leader was killed over the last couple of days, or is there some question about whether or not he was killed?
Yes, I think there are now pictures on YouTube actually showing his dead body. So, you know, there was some speculation as to whether he was actually killed. But I think now there is a consensus that, in fact, he has been.
Mm-hmm. And where did these, was there international cooperation with this group? Where did they get their arms? Where did they get the Air Force?
From all over, you know, it's sort of illegal weapons smuggling and so on and so forth. And most of its financial backing came from the Tamil diaspora in the Western countries. But in the last few years, especially after 9/11, many more countries banned the LTTE as a terrorist organization, making it difficult for it to, you know, receive funding from abroad.
Mm-hmm. So how strong are they? Are they still around?
Well, in the sense that the diaspora network is still there, and that's why I think it's very important to work with the diaspora and the Tamil, Sri Lankan Tamil diaspora, and make them a part of the solution rather than the problem. You know, how to re-engage them in Sri Lanka and to get them involved in rehabilitation, resettlement, and development in Sri Lanka. I mean, that is a key aspect to long-term resolution of this conflict.
Mm-hmm. And what about the United States? Would our new administration agree with that philosophy? Would there be a difference in terms of engaging this group to come and be part of the solution?
I think that the U.S. would be very open to that. I mean, in the statement that President Obama made just last week, you know, he asked the LTTE to lay down arms and to let the civilians go. And, you know, they would want to work with a long-term approach. And I think there is a consensus that the economic approach is as key here, because the civilians have suffered enough. And I think getting them resources, job opportunities, education, building the infrastructure in the north and the east, as well as in the rest of the country where people have also suffered tremendously, is going to be really important. Because in a sense, you know, Sri Lanka won a war which was considered unwinnable by both many local as well as international analysts. And Sri Lanka produced the prototype of global terrorism. But perhaps Sri Lanka can also now be the prototype of global conflict resolution. and create a reconciliation and unity, which many think is not possible, but the impossible seems to be achieved when people, you know, put their energy into it and try to work, you know, towards the betterment of all.
Yes. Sometimes it's so hard to believe, isn't it, Professor Badarge, that so much violence can happen in such a gorgeous place. I hadn't spent a whole lot of time looking at pictures of Sri Lanka, but it is a beautiful country.
Yes, it is a very beautiful country. And, you know, it is the Sri stands for blessed. And it is a blessed place. And in that sense, Sri Lanka perhaps can, you know, show a new model of reconciliation and rebuilding for the rest of the world, which is also facing threats of terrorism, violence, anarchy, suicide bombings, you know, which are happening on a daily basis. Because this is not just a Sri Lankan issue, this is a global issue.
Mm-hmm.
And unless these so-called ethno-religious conflicts are put aside, we cannot face up to the common challenges of environmental destruction, the global financial crisis, so on and so forth, you know, which is decimating the planet and creating so much anguish, poverty and suffering around the world. And I think these focus on ethno-religious conflict takes attention away from the common challenges facing humanity at this time.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls. Our number 800-486-8655, and we start with Gary from Madison. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Joy, and I bo on, Professor.
I'm Kathleen, but it's all right.
Oh, Kathleen. I bo, Professor.
I bo on, yes.
Having some experience with Sri Lanka, visited there a number of times and worked there, I guess I would, do you have any ideas on specific suggestions that can alleviate, maybe, as they say, win the war, now we have to win the peace. What can the government do specifically to prevent this thing from bubbling up again?
Well, I think how the government takes care of the IDPs, they are a welfare, resettlement, rehabilitation is crucial, and also how it deals with the LTT cadres. How it also treats the Sri Lankan soldiers, you know, who sacrifice lives and limbs and their families. That is crucial. You know, the people who have suffered the most from all the communities, you know, their interests need to be put beyond the interests of politicians of all stripes. And two, I think the long-term approach, which focuses on sharing of resources and building up those communities is really necessary. And how the government develops policies to engage the diaspora, especially the Sri Lankan Tamil diaspora, which is dispersed particularly in the Western countries. And also it's not just a government responsibility, because this has also been an international conflict. The international organizations, states, NGOs, civil society actors have been involved in that. And sometimes, you know, they have been a part of the problem rather than the solution. This is also an opportunity for them to see the larger picture and help the people on the ground and to move people away from this polarization and the perception of this in a very limited way as a narrow ethnic conflict.
Gary, what were you doing in Sri Lanka? What kind of work?
I was one of those Peace Corps volunteers back in the late 1960s when Sri Lanka was Ceylon.
Oh.
And then subsequently I visited the country a couple of times with NGO work and also as a tourist. So I've tried to keep my contacts active with observing what's happening, thank goodness for websites and reading the Sri Lankan English newspapers on the web. Emily Wax, who's a reporter for The Washington Post, has done, I think, a pretty good job of capturing sort of what's happening there now and how the war was conducted. So I just appreciate the professor's comments, and I think she's right on the mark that the government has to play a role, the Tamil minority has to play a role, the NGOs and the international community all have to step up to the plate I don't know what the cricket term is, but in the baseball term, it's step up to the plate and make this thing work.
Thank you very much for your comments. Yes.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for the call. I understand that it's been very hard for the press to cover this, that the government has placed restrictions on press coverage.
Yes. I mean, in a situation of war, there is also the real possibility that especially a group like the LTTE could have taken international press people as hostage, and that would have been great capital for them. So there was, you know, that sort of real danger of that. And also because, you know, and I don't know how accurate this is, but there were charges that certain press people and NGOs were really much more favorable towards the LTTE and were not providing a balanced and accurate picture, and that was confounding the military operation. So I think there were a lot of strategic reasons why it was not allowing press into those regions, but I think it's important to remember that being a democracy, Sri Lanka has had a very vibrant press and lots of lively coverage on this conflict, and many of the newspapers, not just the English ones, but even local language ones, have been openly critical of the government, and that has been, you know, part of the Sri Lankan political tradition, and certainly something that needs to be continued. And whatever democratic and civil rights that had to be abrogated during this military offensive need to be, you know, reinstated, and human rights and civil rights, you know, need to be respected and strengthened.
Right. It had been described as one of the more dangerous countries on earth. Is that true? Have you been able to travel? I know it's your homeland. Have you been able to travel freely there, or do you feel worried about going there in the past 2 decades?
Well, I think everyone's been fearful of being there because you just don't know, at least you just didn't know where a suicide bomb would go off, And there were so many terrible suicide bombings and so many assassinations of politicians, dissidents, not just Sinhalese politicians, but the entire Tamil moderate leadership was wiped out by the LTTE. If you remember people like Lakshman Kadiragama, who was a Tamil and a foreign minister, Neelan Thiruchelvam, you know, who was a lawyer, ULF politician, you know, and this was starting in 1975 with the killing of Alfred Dureyappa, the Tamil Jaffna mayor, and that was considered Prabhakaran's, you know, first mark to fame. So no one was secure, and that, you know, transcended ethnic divides. You know, whether one was Sinhalese, Tamil, Muslim, or foreigner, no one was safe on the island. So to remove that terrorist threat is a great relief to all the people. It is not just the Sinhalese who right. are joyous about this, but all the people. But because of its totalitarian tactics and silencing of the Tamil people, many Tamils are not able to openly express their relief or their criticisms of the LTTE, because the Tamils became something of a silenced group. The majority of them were silenced. They were not free to speak. And this gives them an opportunity now to come forward and to build a moderate Tamil leadership.
Mm-hmm. We're going to continue our conversation, and welcome phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. Professor Asoka Badarge is affiliated associate professor, Public Policy Institute at Georgetown University, born and grew up in Sri Lanka, and we're talking about the news of the last couple days, big news, the conflict between the Sri Lankan government and the secessionist liberation tigers of Tamil Eelam, the LTTE, which has been described as one of the world's longest-running contemporary armed struggles. The group is known to have introduced suicide bombing to the world. The internationally banned LTTE, considered the prototype of modern terrorism. Climax of the war was reached yesterday when the LTTE announced the surrender on its website. And now there is a humanitarian issue, but of course, as is often the case for us in distant parts of the world, we're playing catch-up here in terms of finding out exactly what's happened in this important part of the world, an important country. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, this Tuesday we'll be speaking with the author of Soul of the Age, a biography of the mind of William Shakespeare. And he has written a book that he said would approximate what he thinks Shakespeare would have written about his own life. And he divides it into the seven stages: the infant, the schoolboy, the lover, the soldier, the justice, the pantaloon, and oblivion. So it should be a great conversation coming up, hour number two of our show. This hour, Professor Asoka Badarage, and we're talking about Sri Lanka, where there has been big news from that part of the world and that island in the last few days. Our number again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Can you spend a few minutes here, Professor Badarage, talking a little bit about the results of colonialism? Because I'm thinking of other places in the world as you talk about this, British colonialism particularly, and how the story is all too familiar of what happens, the ethnic conflict, the choosing favorites, the minorities trying to rule a majority. What the aftermath is of colonialism and the connection.
Yes, because in many places, colonial rulers used ethnic divides in order to maintain themselves in power and actually introduced ethnic categories which did not exist in the pre-colonial period, you know, to their advantage, because, you know, they needed to find ways of maintaining themselves in power. Because the interest was not of the local people, but of their own political and economic interests. And so it also deepened differences between groups, and some of these traditions were carried on into the post-colonial period, you know, which is what happened in Sri Lanka, particularly with the democratization of politics. When the majority, which had essentially been victimized, the single majority which had been victimized during the colonial period, regained power, because during the colonial period, the language of the majority, the Sinhalese, and its religion, Buddhism, was so marginalized that, you know, they became something of a second-class citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened in the post-colonial period is in trying to redress these imbalances, instead of opening up opportunities, great opportunities for all groups of people, there was something like an affirmative action program, you know, that has been followed elsewhere as well, which constricted the opportunities that had been available to privileged minorities, including the Tamils, the small Eurasian or Berger minority, as well as more Anglophile Sinhalese elites. And so there was a sort of a backlash against these policies towards democratization, because in a way, the inequalities of the colonial period were not sustainable in the post-colonial period, you know, when there was a yearning for greater economic and political independence on the part of the majority. But the problem was that there wasn't economic development in order to accommodate these rising aspirations of the masses of the people, so that the elites of both groups, in this case, the Sinhalese and the Tamils, mobilized the youth from the masses along ethnic lines. which led to, you know, sort of creation of ethnically based conflict.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are so many similarities elsewhere of this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they certainly are. Let's go to Janet from Dubuque. Hi, Janet.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is, and perhaps you already covered this, did the majority people government do as much as they could back 25, 30, 35 years ago to negotiate with the Tamil Tigers and make it a more equal society? The reason I ask this, I had some friends that had spent a number of different times in Sri Lanka, and they said what they had heard was that the government did not negotiate, did not try to pull in the Tamil Tigers or the people as much as they should have. There was some president that was very hard-nosed. Is this true?
Well, yes. I mean, there have been many mistakes made by the Sinhala politicians and Sri Lankan governments. There is no question about that. Because if they had taken different positions, you know, perhaps this terrorist threat could have been put behind much long ago, and the country could have moved towards peace and long-term conflict resolution. But it is important to recognize that unlike many other countries, particularly the Western countries, Sri Lanka has tried to negotiate with the LTT on numerous occasions. It has agreed to cease fires and actually sat at the table with the LTTE 5 or 6 times, and I document this in my book. But during each of those ceasefires and negotiations, the LTTE used those opportunities to arm itself and build itself up militarily. I mean, if you look at what happened with the 2002 ceasefire and the peace process that was facilitated by the Norwegians, during that ceasefire, the LTTE strengthened itself enormously. It really gained control of territories that it never had previously. It was able to develop air capability. So the thing is that to say that the government has not tried to negotiate and find a peaceful solution is certainly not the case. I think the even this present government, when it came to power in 2006, really wanted to continue the peace process and negotiations. But the LTTE, you know, did not honor that, which led to the government taking this very hard stance and a single-minded position on wiping the LTTE out militarily.
Well, thank you very much. That explains it a little more thoroughly. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call, Janet. And why wouldn't the LTTE negotiate in good faith?
Because the LTTE's position has been uncompromising, that it wouldn't settle for anything but a separate Tamil state, Elam, in the north and the east of the island. And it did not want to accept, say, devolution or political decentralization because it felt that that would be, not acceptable in terms of its long-term goals and ambitions.
Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't accept what they might be able to get. They wanted everything.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because this has been a fanatical extremist group, and it knows no compromise. And what is unfortunate is that it was able to present itself as the sole representative of Tamils, which is certainly not a democratic position, but hide behind the cover of as the liberator of Tamils, as representing Tamil interests. And a lot of the world was duped by this narrow ethnic analysis of the conflict, seeing the LTTE as representing Tamil interests, when in fact from the beginning the LTTE was the oppressor of Tamils. They recruited child soldiers forcibly, assassinated all the moderate Tamil leadership, did not allow any dissident positions within the Tamil community, and at the last, at the very end, it was holding on to Tamil civilians who were trying to flee from its clutches and even shooting at some of the civilians who were trying to escape into safety. But there was this perception that they represent the Tamil interest and a failure on the part of many to see the intra-ethnic dimension here, the intra-ethnic conflict.
Right. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a really important hour, and we learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and don't forget my book, which is available on Amazon.com.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yes, you're very welcome. Professor Asoka Badaragay, and you can get her book on Amazon. She said it's The Separatist Conflict in Sri Lanka, Terrorism, Ethnicity, and Political Economy. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. A lot of common themes in other parts of the world running through this hour, although I didn't know very much about Sri Lanka. I've learned a lot this hour. Thank goodness for public radio. Well, we'll be back. We have the news coming up and another hour, this one on Shakespeare. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.